Welcome, everybody. Whether you're on webcam, watching later, and particularly if you are a visitor. My name is Paul Murray. I'm a member of the congregation. And we have an open pulpit in this church, which we're very proud of. And when the minister is away or is off or taking a break, we take turns at doing the service. Today it's my turn. A small thing, if you have a telephone, please turn it off. We will now light our chalice, remembering that this is done in Unitarian churches all around the world as a way of recognizing our shared freedom of thought and in solidarity for those who live in societies where there are few freedoms and even barbaric curtailments in their lives. We light our chalice to help remind us and indeed encourage us to remember that by and large, we in this church community have many advantages, some of which might have been hard earned. And we hope that in that understanding of our good fortune, we do not neglect to scrutinize whether our privilege is to the detriment of others. Our first hymn, Come, Come, Whoever You Are, number 188. Now, the story I'm going to tell you today is about Nika Topa Pokia. Not very long ago, he was the chieftain of a volcanic island in Japan called Aogashima. And in Japan, as you might know, there are 14,000 islands. In this country, I think we have 80, and about 20 are occupied. Now, Nika Topa Pokia was terribly, terribly unpopular. So unpopular that everybody turned away when he appeared. They covered their eyes and they covered their nose. And their parents refused to call their children after him. You see, Nika Topa Pokia had become mega rich. And people were very angry. Not that he'd become rich, because rich people are people too, but because of how he got his money. Now, the volcano on the island was long dead. It had last erupted thousands of years previously, and when it became fully dead, the people started to climb up the mountainside, and they built little houses and grew vegetables, because the ash helped them grow vegetables. And there was a wonderful view from the mountain. And a good thing was that even after those thousands of years, the water was always hot. But the real people of Aogashima didn't notice that over the years, Nika Topa Pokia had been buying up land all around the mountain. And after 10 years, he controlled the whole mountain. And control brought power, which his wife, Desivia, wanted him to use. What's the point of having the land and being the chief if you can't become really, really rich? She said as she continued sharpening her nails. Don't you want our children to have a large inheritance? Surely you want me also to have great riches. And it was true. Desivia had for years been bullying and haranguing her husband to buy this and get her that. And Nika Topa Pokia, being a weak man, succumbed, for he loved his wife, or he thought he did. because she was very, very beautiful. She was so beautiful indeed that men and women would look at her as she passed, and even the animals would stop doing whatever they were doing. And she persuaded Nikatopopokea to set up an army blockade around the mountain and to charge everybody who wanted to cross into the mountain. And that, of course, made Nikatopopokea very, very rich. And it stopped the people going on to the mountain to grow their vegetables and to get to their houses. Until one day, and there is always one day, the soldiers who were blocking the people getting onto the mountain got embarrassed when the people turned on them and refused to sell them anything, even food. The soldiers' wives, who knew all the other women, refused to wash the soldiers' clothes. So there were a lot of smelly men around. And over about a week, the soldiers started to ignore the people as they just began to walk through the blockade. Desevia was furious. All that money she had expected was slipping through her fingers. She noticed that even her cowardly husband was beginning to stand up to her. But Nikatopopokea continued to pay the soldiers. He began to notice, too, that people now began to smile when they saw him, as they realized he was under the spell of a greedy, nasty wife. And then, surprising everyone, Nikatopopokea announced that he was going to give the land around the mountain to the people. All they had to do was to provide his palace with a daily supply of fresh vegetables. And Desevia, well, she became unhappily unmarried and very unrich. And he sent her, Nikatopopokea, ordered that she should be taken to the top of the volcano where it was very, very cold, and she was to live in one of those modular houses which she had heard about. And if you're on your holidays and you go up the volcanic mountain, you will see her great-grandchildren happily growing vegetables and sitting outside their little houses, and perhaps not knowing about greedy Desevia. So, children, what are the lessons of this little yarn? Well, beware of anyone who wants you to do cruel things to become rich. Like the great-grandchildren on the mountain, be happy with what you have. If you become a leader, be honest and kind to those you lead. And most important, don't marry a greedy, nasty person just because they're beautiful. Our second hymn, Bring Many Names, number 23. Our first reading is by John Askin.
Good morning, everyone. This reading is a little bit unusual, even by Unitarian standards, but I hope that the spiritual connection will be achieved. The reading falls on two groups of ears in this congregation. One will, I hope, identify with it quite strongly. The other might be shaking their heads and wondering, what was your man on about? The spiritual values I want to talk about are twofold. One is the whole idea of being in the now, the value of being in the now, living in the moment. And the other is the idea of unconditional love. Now, these kind of spiritual values have been touted by all our religious leaders. They were very big into them. Probably it could be argued that Jesus probably was most into the whole idea of unconditional love, and you might pick out the Buddha as being pushing the idea of being in the now. Either way, I think we'd agree they're wonderful spiritual values. The spiritual source for this particular reading came from my family, female member of my family, who died a few years ago but lived to the ripe old age of 15. I just wonder if the penny is dropping. Her name was Kiki, K-I-K-I, and she was a very clever dog. So clever, in fact, that she got an article published by the Sunday Independent. And if you don't believe me, and why would I lie in such a sacred place, you can easily Google Kiki, K-I-K-I, and Sunday Independent, and she will present herself on her article. The other thing she left was a letter, which she left to me to read at my own discretion, at my own timing, so I decided that this morning was a good time. So this is her letter. An open letter from Kiki to humans. Could I start by saying that people like Grandad, that's me, she called me Grandad, might be unintentionally dismissive of those who have no dogs in their family. It's not fair to expect such people to fully understand the points I want to make. They can only gain partial understanding of our spiritual contribution. Yes, I did say spiritual, and I'm choosing my words carefully. Spending a small fortune on a vet, having your good furniture ruined, having your slippers chewed, having to pick up our poo, being obliged to go for walks, all paint a picture of something you can actually do without. But therein lies the tale, if you'd excuse the pun. For your information, there's probably around 1 billion of us dogs, one for every 8 humans. So we're a significant group. We've been pets for about 15,000 years. Not that we like the word pet. It sits uncomfortably between love, control, ownership, and dependency. Maybe it's just the ownership bit we don't like. Now, when I say we make a spiritual contribution, I'm not saying that God gave us a spirit, though many think that all sentient beings have a spirit. But sure, at the end of the day, who knows? I do have to say at the outset that we both have our imperfections. Most of the time, you return our total vulnerability and helplessness with love and affection. But there are rogue dogs and rogue humans. We've been known to injure and even kill. Ironically, when you decide to treat each other as less than human, you can kill each other in the millions. I think you call it dehumanization, a funny term for us. And yet you claim to be the moral thinkers. Our cousins were wolves, and your cousins were chimpanzee. So who's progressed the most? We dogs try to explain that love is not a conclusion, it's a starting point. It's our default setting, our natural way of moving through the world. We reveal love not as a possession, but a participation. That's probably why we don't like the term dog owners. We're much more than a material possession. Now, can I invite you for a minute or two to think about how we handle the world as opposed to how you handle the world? We don't keep scores. We're not worried about your wealth, your social status, as long as you manage to keep us fed. We don't care who you used to be, who you are, or who you're likely to become. We're always glad to meet you, not because you've returned, but because you're here now, at this moment. We have no baggage from yesterday and no fears about tomorrow. We don't have your cognitive complexity of overthinking things. We give our love not just because it's earned, but because it's part of our nature to just give. Not only do we give, even more importantly, we forgive. To put it in philosophical terms, we love the walk more than the destination. Now, does all this sound familiar? Does it ring a bell? Does it sound like something like what all your spiritual gurus have been saying? Some dog families mourn the fact that our lives are so short, but that's part of our message. With you having all these extra years, you're tempted to think that life will go on forever. Everything can be postponed. But as you discover, it can't. So those of you who are seekers on a spiritual journey, can I summarize what we offer? Well, we teach spiritual truths without the need for rules, doctrines, or holy books. We teach that no words are sometimes more powerful than words, particularly when there are no words available, which often happens. Furthermore, we teach that unconditional love is much more powerful than conditional love. Granda used to say that only God was able to love unconditionally. Humans often waited until somebody had died. Is it any wonder that those of you who have us as family members weep when we leave? Is it any wonder that the other families are mystified? What? You're crying over a dog? Finally, I want to say that we have two real secrets, and they're whispered to you in the language of a wagging tail and hidden in the wisdom of our soulful eyes. The first secret invites you to rediscover a real spark in you, a divine spark, if you will, which tells you that most of your joy comes from your ability to live in the present. That you must let go of the inevitable heartbreaks of living, particularly grief, and dwell as little as possible in the past or in the future. The second secret is to realize that only love matters. And that the more conditions you put on this love, the more you dilute its power to transform both you and those around you. We put no conditions on love. There's an old song, which some of you might remember, though most of you are probably too young. I put in brackets, Kiki suggested I sing it, but I'll spare you that. But I don't have the courage anyhow. The first line was, "How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail." Well, just to say, there's no point in asking how much. We're priceless. Your forever friend, Kiki. Thank you.
Thank you, John. That was lovely. Carpe diem. Seneca, in his Moral Letters, says, "Let us therefore set out wholeheartedly, leaving aside our many distractions, and exert ourselves in this single purpose, before we realize too late the swift and unstoppable flight of time and are left behind. As each day arises, welcome it as the very best day of all, and make it your possession. We must seize what flees." The commentary underneath says, "You will only get one shot at today. You've only 24 hours with which to take it. And then it's gone and lost forever. Will you fully inhabit all of today? Will you call out, 'I've got this,' and do your very best to be your very best? What will you manage to make of today before it slips from your fingers and becomes the past? When someone asks you what you did yesterday, do you really want to answer, 'Nothing?'" And that's from the Daily Stoic, Seneca. Let us take some time to meditate on the extent to which we take for granted our position in life, particularly those of us, not all of us, of course, who have had some fortune in our health, wealth, housing, education, occupation, lifestyle, and family circumstances. And then later, we might ponder the extent to which what we have can mean that others have less. Thank you.
Thank you, Josh. That was lovely. The title of this address today is My Privilege, Whose Deprivation? The first time that I witnessed white privilege, in other words, privilege because of my white skin, was 6 years ago. Myself and a Costa Rican friend were going through immigration, having come off a cruise in the Emirates. "Wait," said my friend, "and you will see what we endure." "You," he said, "go through one gate, and I'll go through the other. You will be speedily scrutinized, I won't." And sure enough, my friend's passport was, unlike mine, examined minutely. Now, you might think that maybe the Costa Rican passport hadn't a good reputation. Quite the contrary. Like our own, it's highly respected. As you may have guessed, my friend is brown-skinned, as he says himself. In equal proportions, Spanish, African, and indigenous Indian. And it's not only at immigration that he has faced unfair attitudes. In the Costa Rican hotel, situated in a rainforest, which he ran and partially owned, you get there by motorboat and are woken at night by howler monkeys banging on your door. Some American guests couldn't initially fathom that he was in fact the boss. And they were rude to him until they realized that he was the person to sort out their supposed dilemma. Their Gucci luggage had got wet in the wash from the boat. Privilege, of course, has many guises. There were the days in early 1930s Ireland when businessmen commonly met twice a day in Bewley's in Dublin. And at the Dublin Horse Show, according to Tony Farmer in his wonderful books Ordinary Lives and Privileged Lives, lean hunting girls who could speak to Galway without using a telephone, and their bronze menfolk revved it up, while in the poor areas, 1 in 8 children suffered from malnutrition, over half from dental caries, and 1 in 5 from eye trouble. And in 1932, only 999 children sat the leaving cert. We have to say, of course, today much has changed. In 2 universities alone in Dublin, there are 22,000 students in Trinity, and UCD has 38,000 students. C.S. Todd Andrews, some people will remember him, he's perhaps unfairly vilified for closing down the Harcourt Street railway line. He went to university when student numbers were in their low thousands. While his parents had 2 small businesses, he remembers being looked down on by the sons and especially the daughters of the professional classes. This was a time of deep division in Irish society. The brackets Protestant Craig Gardner accountancy firm got no business for 20 years after the foundation of the state. The tricolour wasn't flown in Lansdowne Road until 1932. And as Brian Inglis has testified, the most common Church of Ireland, and I wonder was it Unitarian as well, attitude to the new state was to abstain. In Inglis's words, as soon as they found out, that's the Church of Ireland found out, that the new Irish government could be trusted not to appropriate their land, debase the currency, or make general legislative mayhem. They settled down to ignore the state's existence. And in everyday matters, the fact that an Irish state did exist was hardly noticeable. Alex Finlater, of the famed Grocery Family, said that politics of the Free State was simply not mentioned at Protestant tables. And we know this, membership of the Bull Island Golf Club in Dublin, other things being equal, excluded Roman Catholics, families in trade, and Jews. However, on the Catholic side, according to Todd Andrews, it was assumed that the Irish nation, in the mass, was a classless society, except, of course, for the usual tendency of tuppence halfpenny looking down on tuppence. Although he did say that anyone crossing from Grafton Street over O'Connell Bridge could at once see in the crowd the physical economic effects of the class system. He amusingly recalled how urban anti-treaty Republicans like himself had an austere social creed, refusing to wear formal clothes, disapproving of women wearing makeup, and of elaborate wedding ceremonies. However, within 10 years, they were all joining bridge clubs, sampling alcohol, dining out, and even going to France. In other words, they became privileged, or even more privileged. One of the more amusing aspects of Tony Farmer's research is about the dilemma facing civil servants who had 35% of their salaries based on the consumer price index. This was fine when the index was going up, but in 1929, prices generally fell. And in the words of the Civil Service Federation, the use of the index wasn't fair, as it was based on working class, not middle class expenditure and lifestyle. It was claimed that the, and probably with some truth, that the average civil servant's household budget contained items which did not appear at all, or only to a negligible extent, in a working class household. Items such as travel expenses, life insurance, restaurant meals, and books. And the children's education tended to last longer, and there was normally at least one maid employed. At one stage, in fact, there were 28,000 maids in Dublin. And the civil servants added, the index included items such as third-grade margarine, which would not be used by a civil servant, who would also would have purchased in a very different type of shop. So, not unexpectedly, this cementing, even enhancing of privilege and the class system was accepted by the government, giving birth to a newly constructed index and therefore more payment for civil servants. And of course we have to ask, to the detriment of who? We could forget too, as noted by an American psychologist in 1932, how many people in agriculture worked not for wages, but by virtue of being of their family relationship. The boys working on the family farm had literally no money. If they wanted a drink on market day or to go to a hurling match, they had to get cash from their father. And if they worked in a job away from the farm, the wages were frequently paid to the father and not to them. Such were the social patterns of life in the emerging Ireland, a time when one of the only ways to get a job was through influence. Indeed, as late as 1958, Farmer tells us, Aer Lingus infuriated Fianna Fáil backbenchers by telling them that canvassing on behalf of job seekers would disqualify them from consideration. So, after that little foray into our state's early years, it is perhaps time to ask how we now deal with the ethical aspects of being privileged, as many of us, perhaps most of us, are. Like most people, I think, who I feel extremely grateful for having been born in Europe, in Ireland, and to be living in a pleasant Dublin suburb. But first, let's look at United States experience, some of which pertain to the earlier yarn about my Costa Rican friend's encounter with Emirati immigration, and might indeed help us to construct a paradigm on how we might honorably use our privilege. A Global Citizen article stresses that having privilege doesn't mean that an individual is immune from life's hardships. But it does mean having an unearned benefit or advantage that a person receives because of race, gender, sexual orientation, country of origin, language, or ability. Aja Hales, who is described as a social thinker, puts it this way. A privilege is a right or immunity granted as a particular benefit, advantage, or favor. If you're the US president, he says, you cannot go to jail if you are in office. And a Duke University publication tells us that there's a long history of privilege bringing attention to the unearned advantage and inherent power imbalance of certain individuals and groups. And very briefly, we might look at some American cases involving the legal system and see whether we could experience something similar. 8 years ago in Memphis in Tennessee, four black males in hoodies were escorted from a shopping mall for violating the dress code. A week later, at the same shopping center, four white women walked around the center for 2 hours in hoodies and jeans before they were politely asked to remove their hoodies. They weren't ejected and they weren't arrested. But while, of course, we tend to concentrate on discrimination against minority groups, there is often a failure to record what is called privileged omissions. They are a practice of discriminatory inaction that excuses failures to comply with expected standards and rules because of a person's privileged status. A decision maker might, for example, grant exceptions to a privileged person, excusing him or her from the accepted norms in rules and behavior. And such decisions, according to a man called Kenneth Culp Davis, on when to be lenient can be misleading and undermine justice. There was a story in the United States, Florida Highway Patrol got involved in the practice of speed discounting, favoring certain people by recording their speeding at a lower level. Such bias in favor, or privileged omission, is not amenable to being highlighted. Indeed, the beneficiaries may be oblivious to the advantage they have received, or perceive their experience as normal or deserved. perpetuating a cycle of inequality. Privileged omissions, it is said, reinforce the status quo by keeping the infractions of privileged individuals out of the public eye. We are told how if white students and black students display the same level of unacceptable behavior, privileged omissions could excuse the white students from punishment, and similar biases can also occur in hiring and firing. And although reported outside Ireland, these practices force us to examine the extent to which we allow ourselves to exercise our privilege, overtly or covertly, fairly or unfairly, and the extent to which we either take advantage of privileged omissions or exercise it. Lee Ann Royster of Duke University says we should not feel guilty about our privilege and we shouldn't want to give it up, but rather we should use our power and privilege to do things effectively around equity and inclusion. In our privilege, we should at least seek to facilitate others to an equality similar to that of ourselves. We should perhaps be chipping away at the use of entitlements which disfavor others, examining those areas of Irish life which evade scrutiny. Given the nature of work, is it an unfair privilege that only 1/3 of Irish workers are able to work from home? I'm not so sure. When we hear a barrister pleading that, quotes, no useful purpose would be served by jailing this young man who would find prison unduly hard, are we alert to class bias? How does it or antennae respond when wealthy citizens fight like dervishes to stop the erection of social houses or traveller sites near them? Should Indigenous Irish have first rights over new arrivals to school places in a local area? When Minister for Justice, the late Des O'Malley, said in the 1970s that prison conditions were often better than those in the homes of inmates, what did that tell us about privilege in our country? If we buy a monstrous heavy car, how many people are we depriving of public space and clean air? And perhaps most pertinent of all, is there an ethical cap on the extent to which we should fight for our privileges when we don't examine whether this fight is undermining the rights of others? If we campaign, as many people do, for the tax-free threshold on inheritances to be increased, how many hospital beds, carers' salaries, and disability aids could be lost? Is it not unjust and contrary to the common good that as parents die, families keep accumulating generation after generation, with adult children in comfortable middle and upper class areas being left with up to €400,000 tax-free without a means test or perhaps assessment for any special needs? Never before, we are told by the central bank, has there been so much intergenerational wealth in Ireland. Is this the society that we want? One where the already privileged are being given even more privilege at the expense of the common good? For those who don't agree with this, let us accept that there is a wider message, that we should be wary of how our privilege and seeking more of it can be to the detriment of others. We should perhaps be wary of skipping, as I did once, a medical clinic queue because the consultant was a former teammate. I feel ashamed of that nearly 40 years later. And as the Duke University academic enjoins us, we should use the privilege that we have to encourage equity and inclusion. We should ask ourselves whether our attitudes to society and in politics reinforce the privileges of a certain set of people to the detriment of others. When Jennifer Roche, if I'm pronouncing her correctly, wife of Peter Hegseth, the US Secretary for Defense, wore a gown worth $42, was she doing it in solidarity with those who can't afford more? As an example of good housekeeping, apparently Washington is agog, and if so, was she aware that a gown of that price most probably came from an Asian sweatshop? And to conclude, it's the kind of question we perhaps should ask ourselves, for example, when we buy fast fashion or use probably carcinogenic weed killers. If nothing else, the experiences outlined above would hopefully sharpen our antennae in balancing our rights with those of others. And such balances help to make us truly human. Thank you. Our third hymn, Our World Is One World, number 134. Thank you to everyone who contributed to our service, and please, of course, join us for coffee and tea downstairs. Thank you, John, for a lovely reading. Thank you, Peter, Therese, Margaret, Alison, and Daniela. And thank you to our collectors, Janet, Madeline, Trish, and Will. Pam holds her weekly service of reflection in the church every Wednesday from 1:05 to 1:35. And we can also access this on our webcam. Our annual plant sale will be on Sunday the 10th of May downstairs after the service, and all proceeds to Christian Aid. Also next Sunday, Gavin and Dietmar will meet Sunday Club volunteers and parents to discuss the programme. The next Heart and Soul session will be on Monday, the 18th of May at 7 o'clock. Please contact Shari if you wish to participate. The last Sunday's At Two concert will take place on Sunday, the 24th of May at 2 o'clock. All of these notices will be posted on our weekly email from Josh. And if you want to receive that newsletter, please give your email to him. And a special thank you to Josh for the music today. Our fourth hymn, and final hymn, We'll Build a Land, number 121. Let us leave this sacred place
in peace, intending to be fair in all our dealings, particularly as they could affect others. Let us remember that life is just a journey in which we can have many choices on how we can enhance ourselves and, most importantly, others. May the road rise before you. May the sun shine upon your face. May the wind be always at your back. And until we meet again, may the goddess hold you and yours in the palm of her hand. Thank you.